I have helped to organize this, and I am so pleased that we have so many people here, especially so many people who are thinking that they really would like to be doctors and maybe would consider studying in Cuba. I think you've come to the right place. Let me start out by saying that you all know about technology, right? Something about technology. You know how just when you think you've got it all licked, it bites you. It comes around and bites you. My computer doesn't connect to this multimedia player. And so we were going to have this little part of the program be an audio visual, not audio, I would be the audio, a visual program presentation that would kind of catch your attention because it's not just talking. Well, guess what? It's going to be just talking. We have a PowerPoint prepared on the scholarship program for the Latin American school. And so I want you, while I'm pulling this up, because I'm going to use this as my notes, I would like for you to pretend that there on the screen you see a white sand beach with turquoise water. It's beautiful. And then on the beach there's a building, I think it's 4 or 5 stories high, picture it, a brilliant white with blue trim, in a gorgeous setting. That's the Latin American School of Medicine. Before 1998, it was a naval academy, and that made sense because it was on the ocean. But as Alicia alluded to, and I need to pay attention to my computer so that I can pull this up. But as Alicia alluded to in her talk, Hurricanes Mitch and George rushed through the Central American area, and probably some of you remember there were thousands of mudslides, tremendous mudslides, and thousands and thousands of lives lost in that area. And as so often happens, of course, we don't hear about it here in the United States unless you listen to alternative media like Free Speech Radio News. But Cuban doctors almost always are just there right after the disaster happens. So as the hurricane was kind of blowing out one side of the Central American area, Cuban doctors were flying in. And Cuba is used to going into third world areas, but they were really appalled by the lack of medical care that the people had never had medical care. So they came back to Cuba and they said, you know, we've got to do something about this. This is too big for us to handle. That it's a problem that we can solve better by training doctors to go back, to come to Cuba, study medicine, and go back to their own home country. So that's when the idea was conceived for the Latin American School of Medicine. That was in 1998. The two hurricanes came through, I think, in November of 97, and by September of 98, the school was ready. It had been renovated, and it was a school. I am so sorry. I just cannot talk and find this thing at the same time, so I will look for it. Huh? You know what? I've got, oh no, I don't even have it on my, I mean, I have it on my flash drive. I'm sorry, you guys. It's going to come up then, and then I'll be able to, here it is. Anyway, the school itself has, help me with this, has anyone here visited the Latin American School of Medicine besides Ellen? Oh, good, yeah. So we've got some experts here. I know that they have, here we go. I've got it at last. It has 28 buildings, so it's a big campus, has 80 classrooms, and 37 laboratories, 5 amphitheaters, dormitories, and an infirmary. And did I mention that it's on the seacoast? Yeah. Yeah. Right now there are over 10,000 students studying there, and they come from 28 nations. Now, what some of our students, I don't know if Lucius has mentioned it already, but we have almost 100 American U.S. students who are there now. What some of them were surprised to find is that the Latin American School of Medicine is only for foreign students. That is, there aren't any Cuban students studying at the Latin American School of Medicine. So it's a two-year program there in that particular, on that particular campus. So the students come from 28 nations. They come from Latin America. They come from the Caribbean. I believe there are five African nations that have students there. And now, of course, there are U.S. students. So we're very pleased with that. They have a lot of extracurricular activities that they do, and I have them listed here: arts and sports and film and disco, and a regular cultural house activities where students come together and share aspects of their culture. So the Haitian students would put on a program, and the Honduran students would put on a program, and apparently it's a lot of fun and very educational. And then there's the beach. Although I don't want to play up the beach too much, because the truth is the students that I've talked to say they are so busy studying, they don't have a lot of time to enjoy the beach. But it's there. The program, there's a six-month pre-med course, and that includes biology, introduction to health sciences, chemistry, math, and physics. And then most of our students who go down there are not fluent enough in Spanish to really cope with the Spanish of Cuba, in which case there's a 12-week of intensive Spanish that the students take. And then, of course, because the Latin American School of Medicine is just for non-Cuban students, as I understand it, your Spanish continues being supported during the 2 years that you're there, because there are students from other countries. Several of the African countries from Africa don't speak Spanish, and of course Haitians don't speak Spanish, so the U.S. students are not the only ones who are learning Spanish as they're learning medicine. The general plan of study goes like this. On the first 2 years, there's the introduction to basic medical sciences. And then years 3 through 5, you have clinical courses at one of the other 21 teaching hospitals on the island. There are a total of 22 hospitals on Cuba, which is a fairly small island, really, with 11 million people, 22 hospitals. And then the very last year is an internship program with rotations in internal medicine, pediatrics, obstetrics and gynecology, surgery, and general medicine. So, the six-year medical school program, you can tell I'm just reading this, including the one-year internship, begins every September and logically is divided into 12 semesters. As I say, the students study it at the Latin American School of Medicine for the first 2 years. After that, your Spanish is good enough so that you can compete. That is the wrong word. Don't ever say that again. Cubans don't compete, and that's one of the beautiful things. In fact, I had the privilege of talking to some of our students who say, "Wow, what a different sort of an atmosphere." Because here, I understand, I haven't had this experience myself, but I understand that doctors going through schools here will actually study and then rip the pages out of the reference books so that nobody else knows that part of it, because it's so competitive. In Cuba, it's quite the opposite. Everyone helps everyone else in a spirit of solidarity. So they're not competing, but you're able. So my point was that after the first 2 years, you go to one of the other 21 schools and you're able to
enter.
Thank you. I was looking for that word. Yeah. So, and then the other 4 years are with Cuban students, because your Spanish is good enough to do that. The program is based on intensive advising and tutoring to help every student succeed, and they really are serious about that. They want everyone to do well. Students are given competency exams at appropriate courses in points in the course of study. The scholarship provides for tuition, full tuition, room and board, which of course includes all your food, the uniforms that you wear, books in Spanish, and I guess we're more and more books now. We're getting some books in English in the library too. And Cuba even gives each student a small stipend. And people have asked me, how much do they give as a stipend? They give the equivalent of what the lowest paid worker in Cuba earns a month. So it's not a lot, but it's enough for essentials. And it's more than generous, because they're giving you a free education that's worth $200,000 or more. The criteria to become a student under our program is that you have to be a U.S. citizen. Of course, if you live in Honduras, you're a Honduran citizen. If you live in Ghana, you're a Ghanaian citizen. For our program, you have to be a U.S. citizen. You have to have proficiency in college-level science classes. You have to be 30 years of age or under. You have to be committed to practicing medicine in underserved communities in the United States. And then a cautionary note is that all applicants first are pre-screened by IFCO Pastors for Peace, and then the final decisions are made by the personnel of the Latin American School of Medicine. So I know that Lucius and the group in New York sends the applications to the Latin American School of Medicine, and they make the final decision. And then I have here, the selection process is a stringent one. Students with a solid background in college-level science courses have a better chance of admission. And then some quick background, because I know Ellen is really going to talk about it, but as I said before, when Cuban doctors volunteered after Hurricanes George and Mitch in 1998, they saw that medical care had never been available in most of those places. So within months, Cuba established the Latin American School of Medicine. How it happened that the U.S. got involved was that Reverend Walker was taking a small group of Congressional Black Caucus leaders down to Cuba to visit schools and hospitals and clinics, and they went to the Latin American School of Medicine. It wasn't open to U.S. students at that time, and the personnel at the school were explaining to the Congressional Black Caucus leaders that they had seen that there were people in the Central American area that had never had health care. And a representative from the Mississippi Delta, Representative Benny Thompson, raised his hand and said, you know, there are people in my area that have never had health care either. And that gave the personnel and President Fidel Castro the idea, whoa, that's true, we knew that. So that was in June of 2000. In September of 2000, President Castro was in the United States at the United Nations, and in the Riverside Methodist Church there in New York City, he made the announcement, and this is a quote, "We are prepared to grant a number of scholarships to poor youth who cannot afford to pay the $200,000 it costs to get a medical degree in the United States." And that was just, people, can you imagine? I mean, what a statement. I was, wow! Of course, the whole place burst into applause. And I know, I feel that way too. I feel that. And then I'm so sorry you can't see this, because not only does Fidel not eat babies, he is the most humanitarian leader I think he has to be one of the top 10 for all times. And this is a direct quote about what Fidel has said about the Latin American School of Medicine. What we want from the Latin American School of Medical Sciences is for students from our sister nations to become imbued with the same doctrine with which our own doctors are educated, with that total devotion to their noble future profession. For a doctor is like a shepherd, a priest, a missionary, a crusader for the people's health and physical and mental well-being. Thank you, Fidel. So
Cuba's healthcare achievements are universal and free, and that has happened ever since the revolution triumphed in 1959. It's always been a priority. There's one physician for every 168 people throughout the country. It's not concentrated in Havana. It's at the peaks of the Sierra Maestra. There are medical doctors there for everyone. That makes Cuba have the, how do you express it? It, the highest or the lowest ratio of doctors to population. They have more doctors per people than any, thank you, per capita, than any other country on the face of the earth. There are over 2,000 new physicians that graduate every year, and remember that the country is 11 million strong. They have the lowest infant mortality rate and the highest life expectancy in all of Latin America. And a large number of common diseases, such as measles, mumps, polio, diphtheria, are virtually unheard of on the island. And by the way, I was a kindergarten teacher. You may know that our children, to go to start kindergarten, have to have 5 vaccinations. Do you know how many vaccinations Cuban children have before they enter school? 13. They're vaccinated against things that we don't vaccinate our kids. And then I have a list of statistics that I won't go into, except to say that Cuba just really completely outshines other Latin, Central, and South American countries in all sorts of fields. AIDS, diphtheria, not diphtheria, that they virtually don't have any, tuberculosis. Even countries like Costa Rica that we have somehow in our mind that are kind of advanced, or Argentina, excuse me, Alicia. Cuba is just way, way above in terms of all of their health statistics. Many incidents of illnesses have decreased over the past year, and their AIDS rate at the present time, their infection rate, is 0.7%, which makes it one of the lowest infection rates of any country in the world. So that's how they're doing with AIDS. In 2004, Cuba had a birth rate, that is a birth mortality rate of less than 6 per 1,000 live births. That's equal to Canada's. The United States rate has a mortality rate of 7, which you say, oh, hey, but in African American communities, it's over 14 deaths per live birth. So they do much better than we do. Life expectancy is actually comparable to expectancy in the United States. And you think, yeah, well, fine. Well, you know, Cuba is a developing nation. Cuba is not the kind of a nation we have with a lot of technology and a lot of innovative things, mostly, I'd say, because of the blockade. But to think that they have the same life expectancy that we do under circumstances that are more difficult is really an amazing, just an amazing accomplishment. There's at least one doctor and one nurse in residence for every 120 families. Internationally, they're famous for their meningitis and AIDS treatments. Of course, we don't hear about it in the United States, thanks to the information blockade against us. Before the revolution triumphed in 1959, almost all of the doctors were white men who lived in Havana. And now, 44% of all doctors throughout, 48% are women, and there are a lot of people of color, and as I say, they are in parts of Cuba that are still not on the electrical grid, but they have good health care. They have wonderful health care. They've sent doctors all over the world. They've propped up at a collapsed health system in Haiti. They've provided health care all over the world. As Alicia said, there were over 3,000 Cuban doctors that went to Pakistan after the hurricane it was an earthquake, a terrible earthquake. Do you remember that? Our country sent 11 helicopters to truck in, of the like 250 that we had over there at that time. Cuba. And not only did the Cuban doctors go there, they stayed in the tents, they stayed within the conditions that the people themselves were living in. It was unheard of. I knew I was going to give this talk today, and so I looked it up last night. And people in Pakistan, as Alicia said, first of all, they didn't even know Cuba existed. And then for doctors to come and live with the people, it's just that, like, doctors come and they live in the five-star hotels and they drive out to where people need them and then they go back to the five-star hotels. So it was really quite an experience. And for people who say, probably you all have heard that that Cuba has, I think, about 18,000 doctors in Venezuela now. And our government is fond of saying, oh, yeah, but they get oil, so it's, you know, it's somehow it's supposed to be a trick, according to the way our government thinks about it. And I like to remind people that in Pakistan, there were 3,000 doctors that went there and worked there for 6 months and longer and didn't ask for a penny. They were just there. In fact, the Cuban doctors receive their salaries from Cuba. They don't even receive salaries from the country that they go in to help. How remarkable is that? You know, when Reverend Walker says, please suspend disbelief, it's kind of constantly, really? Really? So, anyway. I think we've pretty much... Oh, I did want to mention one other thing. I found when I talked to college students that a lot of people don't remember Chernobyl. But people my age, and even slightly younger than me, but maybe not in their 20s, Chernobyl, does people remember what Chernobyl was? Yeah, see, people my age. Chernobyl, did it happen in 1986, I think. Chernobyl was a nuclear reactor in the Ukraine, and it imploded on itself, and it sent strontium-90 and all this horrible stuff over hundreds, I think thousands of miles. People are still being affected by it. I mean, the grass, the cows, it just was a horrible thing, and of course, all kinds of radiation sickness of different kinds, including leukemia. Cuba started, and I remember when the United States government touted the fact that they brought 20 families over to be treated. Cuba, to date, has treated over 18,000 children from the Ukraine. They fly them over. Not only do they fly the children over to treat them, they fly the whole families over. How are you going to take a little girl who speaks Russian, 6 or 7 years old, and put her in a country where they speak Spanish and eat rice and beans instead of what she's used to? You can't do that to the family. So they fly whole families over, and they take care, they provide for the whole family while they're giving the children treatment. And because of that, Cuba has become the world's foremost leader in radiation sicknesses. They're the foremost expert in how to treat radiation. So Cuba's just... could go on and on. Yes, ma'am.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd be curious. I'm interested to know about the asthma ratio in Cuba and how it's an epidemic here, especially in
It Chile. Surely is. It surely is, and especially among minority communities that are more likely to be. Yeah, I don't know the statistic on that. Ellen? Good. Great.
I can answer the question. My mouth is
closed. Go.
we'll get to
it. Okay.
We'll do it later.
Oh, okay. All right. So anyway, in addition to all of this, Cuba has trained hundreds of students from African and Latin American nations, and again, free of charge, the Ukraine children are being treated. Okay, so let's get down to frequently asked questions. After people ask me or ask us, what's the catch? And you say, no catch. This is just Cuba's way of expressing solidarity with people in the world. Then there's some specific questions. Okay, if doctors are trained in Cuba, can they be licensed to practice in the United States?
Yes.
Big question. Okay, I'm going to answer that. But I've got the questions first, and then we'll go to the answers. Will U.S. students in the Cuba medical program be equipped to pass those, they're called United States medical licensing exams, and they call them USMLEs. For short, I've learned that because I'm not a doctor either, obviously. Will the graduates have a hard time getting residencies in U.S. hospitals? And what's in it for Cuba? Why would Cuba want to be helping U.S. citizens? And is this program a serious medical education, or an opportunity for a Cuban publicity stunt? Okay, so the first question. The question around licensing, yeah, here's the deal. All international medical graduates have to pass step one, step two, and clinical assessment evaluation, the same exams that U.S. medical students have to take. They have to take those. Now, in other words, all medical graduates, no matter where you graduate from, so you can graduate from Pakistan or South Korea or wherever you graduate from, that the school that you go to doesn't matter as long as you can pass that test. If you can pass those the step one, two clinical assessment, and then each state has its own little test. But if you can pass those, you're licensed to practice in the United States. So that's a biggie. That's a biggie. Now, here's a caveat here. I don't know. According to the National Board of Medical Examiners, only 48% of foreign medical school graduates pass the boards, compared with 92% of U.S. and Canadian medical school graduates. Ah, but there's a doctor in the University of South Florida College who says, wait a minute, that statistic is misleading, because most foreign school graduates are speaking English as their second language. Our students are coming back speaking English as their first language, and then on top of it, they're bilingual in Spanish. So that statistic, people have said, yeah, well, I hear not as many foreign school graduates pass that test. That the reason, I think, is probably that they're speaking a language that's not their first language. So the doctor from the South Florida College says, fact, these students are going to learn something they can't learn in the United States, and that's how to get the best outcomes with the least amount of resources. And I know from talking to students who have gone there, they say, you know, I'm learning so much more than if I had just been taught how to use the machine. I'm learning how to really work in circumstances and in areas where I wouldn't have the access to the latest technology. It's better. Meanwhile, U.S. doctors from IFCO Medical School Committee are working closely with the faculty to assure that all medical materials covered by the USMLEs are thoroughly mastered by the students. As a matter of fact, the students meet three times a week from their first year at the school to prepare themselves for the exams. So they're getting a good education. Let's see. Residency programs are very competitive, but students who ace the exams will be highly desirable. I have to tell you, and you all may know, that our first graduate, he graduated earlier than the rest of the students. Most of our students started in April of 2001. But one man, Cedric Edwards, had started earlier because he had already taken some medical classes at the University of Louisiana. And so he was placed ahead when he went to Cuba. And he graduated in the very first graduating class of the Latin American Medical School in 2005. And he's gotten residency in Montefiore, which is in the Bronx, which is, I understand, a very prestigious school. So that's our first one. So we have some other students who are coming back this June. So we'll see how that goes. But we're expecting them to do very well, too. In terms of, is it a publicity stunt? Obviously, we know that it's not. Dr. Juan Carrizo, the rector of the Latin American School of Medicine, says, this is about medical school training that's rooted in the deepest concept of humanity, because we hope that one day these students will become health missionaries in their own countries. Their goal is to produce doctors who care about people and not the bottom line. There are personal questions, cautionary notes, because there are some hardships involved. It's not a bed of roses. In addition to the fact that it's a very rigorous program where students are expected to study hard, it's not for sissies. You're far away from home, and you know, Cuba is only 90 miles away from Florida. You think, how far away is that? Except because of the United States blockade against Cuba, it just seems like it's further because it's harder to get mail and packages and stuff. So it's more isolated than it would be if our government allowed normal relations to take place. So that can be a problem. There's no peanut butter, there's no macaroni and cheese, there's no french fries, there's no milkshakes. After a while, you get really sick of beans and rice and seasonal fruit. And you certainly don't starve, but it's not what most U.S. students are used to, so you just kind of have to keep that in mind. There are some third world conditions in terms of physical comforts that can be talked about later. Limited access to the internet, which can be frustrating, not within walking distance of shopping, and you live together in dorms, and it's a little bit more crowded than what U.S. than we're all used to. It can be as many as eight people to a single room, and it's group living at its finest. However, for the students that I've talked to say it's definitely worth it because studying at the Latin American School of Medicine means that you have people-oriented training, you have individual attention, you graduate from a medical school debt-free, and you have the experience of living and studying in a country as wonderful and fascinating as Cuba. So, thank you.